The attack was a triumph of military intelligence as well as a masterpiece of military planning. The Japanese Empire's spies had provided Admiral Yamamoto's forces with the kind of precise advance information that allowed them to achieve complete surprise. Author Denise Frisino's research into pre-Second World War Japanese espionage in Hawaii is the background of her historical novel Orchids of War, in which all the elements of a thriller are provided by real-life history.
December 1941, before the war broke out, the Japanese, and still after because they were really needed on the bases and thereabouts, but they were highly regarded as workers. And so they were in and off the base constantly, and that basically remained for a lot of the war. There were some that were taken to relocation camps. There were some that were later on and that were arrested immediately that day, and those were the ones that were inside the consulate that they took in immediately.
And that's you're talking about the Japanese consulate here
in Honolulu.
In Honolulu, Hawaii.
Yeah.
And yet there was a spy embedded in the consulate, is that right?
There were quite a few spies that were embedded. Actually, the main one, there was one for sure. He was 27 years old, and he'd been there for almost 9 months in Hawaii. And he went under the name of Tadashi Moramura, and his real name was Takeo, Takeo Yoshikawa.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and he was flamboyant. He wore Hawaiian shirts. He wore his hair long. He was in the Navy, the Japanese Imperial Navy, and he trained for a long time before they sent him over. But he did all kinds of, he rode in airplanes with one of the geisha women from a tea house up in the mountains that he loved to spend time in, which had a wonderful direct view of Pearl Harbor and Fort Island. And he would go in the airplanes. He would dive underwater to see if there really were submarine nets. He would dress as a worker, and he would walk the sugarcane fields next to the air bases. So he was responding back to Tokyo twice a week, if not more. And then in September, they sent him a message giving him specifics of what they wanted him to provide them. And one of them was a map, a grid. They wanted Pearl Harbor broken into 5 sections. And he was the one who gave them pictures and the map that showed where all of the Navy, how it was laid out.
Pretty valuable information.
Extremely valuable and easily gotten. That was the sad. We were asleep at the wheel, more than asleep. But he had some other friends that he was working with, and one was he had some specific a taxi driver that he liked to use. And then he also would use they had a car that went with the consulate, and he would have that driver take him around. He observed Kaneohe, Eba. Made himself comfortable around the island.
Well, Denise, it sounds as if he was able to contribute significantly to the effectiveness of the December 7th attack. Is that right?
Absolutely. His last message, later when he was interviewed, because here's what happened to him. The day of the Pearl, they instantly realized he and this other gentleman that he was working with, and his name was Kito, they ran to the consulate. They were having breakfast. They ran to the consulate, and they started burning everything. He said smoke was just coming out of out of the chimney. And then the FBI arrived at about 9:30 and took them prisoners, and they kept them in the consulate and wouldn't let them leave. Then they shipped them. They shipped Tadashi, his spy name, to Phoenix, Arizona, and they grilled him for 7 days straight. Unfortunately, they didn't realize he gave up nothing, and they did not realize how much he played, what a strong part he was He gave Yamamoto everything he needed, all of the details. These two boats are moored here, and they're together, things of that sort. But then there was an exchange. There was an exchange on the Swedish boat and the Gripsholm in August of 1942, and he was among them. And he was sent back as a diplomatic prisoner exchange to Japan. And then he continued to work in espionage in Tokyo until the occupation, at which point in time he disguised himself as a Buddhist monk and hid in the hills until after the occupation. Then he went back to the wife that he had just married.
He managed to go pretty much unpunished for what could have gotten him hanged, yeah?
Absolutely, except that his countrymen, in about 1953, when they heard his story, they blamed him. In an interview, he said they blamed him for the bomb, for the war. And he had tried to open a candy store, and no one would frequent it. And so his wife ended up having to totally support him throughout the rest of his life.
That's as a writer of fiction and nonfiction, you recognize that as the kind of story that you can't make up.
Precisely. This is a compilation of many, many sources that I have put together on him. And I use him in my book, of course, in Orchids of War, and then in the sequel, Storms from a Clear Sky, because he played such a paramount. And it just shows how vulnerable we were. Now, we were reading the messages that were leaving the consulates. America had developed a means of reading these messages, and we were reading the ones that were being sent from Tokyo to Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., but we were low-staffed. We weren't putting it together fast enough to know that how imminent it was or where the strike was going to be. Everyone really thought it was the Philippines, which, of course, the Japanese did get the next morning.
The next day, yeah.
Yeah.
How does all this become the action of a work of fiction?
Well, thanks for asking that one, because it has been 6 years in the making. So when I take these stories, when I find out these things about these people, or if I interviewed the first man who was shot at Kaneohe, I take what happened to him that morning, and I have my characters acted out. And for instance, I do have a scene in the hills above Pearl Harbor where one of my characters actually is at a dinner party, and he runs into Tadashi. And they're standing there observing Pearl Harbor below, and he's not aware that he's standing next to the major spy who's going to turn over hand over Pearl Harbor on a map back to Tokyo. So I interweave the truth in with my characters.
That can be a very effective way of presenting the truth, can't it?
Well, absolutely. And it's a truth that has gone unspoken for years. The web that was from Canada to Mexico along our west coast was very sophisticated. Again, they were sending messages via the consulate, which, America couldn't enter, and they were sending them back to Tokyo, and Tokyo was sending things, let's say, to Seattle. Sato was our main man here, and he was sending messages about the Bremerton shipyards and Boeing and saying, this warship left this time and it's carrying this cargo. So a lot of information prior to the outbreak of the war was being supplied back to Tokyo. And one of the most interesting things, too, is how long the process was to develop the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, Yamamoto formally suggested it in January of 1941. Once the plan was accepted, they actually had an island in Japan that looked an awful lot like Oahu. They built it to look exactly like Pearl Harbor and spent months practicing the attack. So, that played into it a great deal as well.
Denise Frazino is the author of Orchids of War, published last year by the Book Publishers Network. You can learn more about her and her work on the Conversations Facebook page.